Although this was his first visit to Brazil, Magellan was familiar with the brilliantly evocative descriptions of the land written by Amerigo Vespucci after his visit in 1502. In his words, Brazil and its natural wonders were the closest approximation to paradise that Magellan was likely to encounter during his entire voyage around the world. Vespucci reported, "This land is very delightful and covered with an infinite number of green trees and very big ones which never lose their foliage, and through the year yield the sweetest aromatic perfumes and produce an infinite variety of fruit, gratifying to the taste and healthful to the body. And the fields produce herbs and flowers and many sweet and good roots, which are so marvelous that I fancied myself to be near the terrestrial paradise." At the time of Magellan's arrival, there may have been as many as 400,000 Guarani Indians grouped by dialects. They occupied huge regions of South America extending all the way to the Andes and lived communally in huts sheltering about a dozen families each. Polygamy was not unknown to them, but it was not common. They were short, rarely more than 5 feet tall, and by European standards, stout. The men wore a simple G-string and occasionally a headpiece made of feathers. The women were fully clothed. They were adept at pottery, wood carving, and skillful in their weapons of choice, the bow and arrow and the blowgun. The arrival of the Armada de Molucca in Rio de Janeiro coincided with heavy rains that ended a 2-month drought in the region. Pigafetta wrote, "The day we arrived, the rain began, so that the people of the place said that we came from heaven and had brought the rain with us." The sight of the strange ships arriving in the harbor inspired benign rather than warlike feelings in the hearts of the Indians, as Pigafetta would learn. Yet the Guarani Indians disturbed Pigafetta. He had no doubt that the Indians practiced cannibalism and provided a gruesome description of how it had become part of their everyday life. "They do not eat the bodies all at once, but everyone cuts off a piece and carries it to his house where he smokes it. Then, every week, he cuts off a small bit, which he eats thus smoked with his other food to remind him of his enemies." As Magellan's ships came to rest, a throng of women, all of them naked and eager for contact with the sojourners, swam out to greet them. Deprived of the company of women for months, the sailors believed that they had found an earthly paradise. Any fear they might have had of Indian cannibals melted in the flame of carnal pleasure. Discovering that the women were for sale, the sailors gladly exchanged their cheap German knives for sexual favors. Night after night on the beach, the sailors and the Indian women drank, danced, and exchanged partners in moonlit orgies. But there were limits, said Pigafetta. "The men gave us one or two of their young daughters as slaves for one hatchet or one large knife, but they would not give us their wives in exchange for anything at all." Under the strain of temptation, one of Magellan's most trusted allies, Duarte Barbosa, who had offered critical assistance when Cartagena mutinied, all but lost his head in Rio de Janeiro. Falling under the women's spell and envisioning a life of ease as a trader on these distant shores, he decided to desert the fleet. Magellan learned of the plan and intervened at the last minute, sending sailors to arrest Barbosa on shore and drag him back to the ships. The poor man spent the rest of the layover in Rio de Janeiro, confined in fetters aboard his ship, gazing on the women and the self-indulgent life that Magellan and duty denied him. While the sailors pursued their casual liaisons with the Indian women, Magellan transacted business with their men. He took on fresh supplies of water and provisions, trading insignificant trinkets, such as the tiny bells that he had brought with him from Seville, for precious food. Wrote Pigafetta, "The people of this place gave for a knife or fishhook 5 or 6 fowls, and for a comb a brace of geese. For a small mirror or a pair of scissors, they gave us as many fish as 10 men could have eaten. For a bell or a leather lace, they gave us a basketful of fruit." The captain general and the fleet's 3 priests intended to maintain strict religious observance throughout the voyage, both to keep their own sailors faithful and to impress the local inhabitants with the power of Christianity. And the impressionable Indians eagerly accepted Magellan's invitation to attend worship. Pigafetta wrote, "Mass was said twice on shore, during which those people remained on their knees with so great contrition and with clasped hands raised aloft that it was an exceedingly great pleasure to behold them." The tranquility of the fleet's layover in Rio de Janeiro was interrupted by a traumatic event, carrying out Antonio Salomon's death sentence on December 20th. On the appointed day, Magellan summoned the officers and crew of Trinidad to watch the execution of the man who had committed a crime against nature. One of the sailors, never named, his face likely hooded to preserve his anonymity, strangled Salomon in full view of the other men as a warning. The grisly spectacle, performed with military efficiency, increased resentment among the crew against the captain general. There are conflicting accounts concerning Antonio Genovese, the cabin boy whose life Magellan had spared. In one version, Genovese suffered such extreme ridicule from other crew members that he threw himself overboard and was lost. And in another, the cabin boy, an object of scorn, was thrown overboard to his death. No matter which version was correct, the double tragedy marked the only time Magellan addressed the subject of homosexuality throughout the voyage. 5 days later, the Armada de Malacca observed its first Christmas away from Spain in the shelter of Rio's harbor. But there was little time to reflect on the holiday because the men busily prepared the ships for departure. Just before sailing, Magellan replaced Antonio de Coca, the fleet accountant who had briefly assumed command of San Antonio from Cartagena, with the inexperienced Alvaro de Mesquita. Both de Coca and Cartagena took the shuffle as an insult because Mesquita had shipped out aboard the flagship from Seville as a mere supernumerary. The deposed captains cried nepotism, which was true, because Mesquita was Magellan's cousin. After 2 weeks of central indulgence, the fleet's departure from Rio de Janeiro on December 27th became an emotionally charged affair. João López Carvalho, Magellan's pilot, returning to Brazil after a 7-year absence, happily reunited with his former mistress, who introduced him to their son. Carvalho took an immediate liking to the lad, whom he called Joãozito, and enlisted him as a servant aboard ship. As the fleet prepared to embark, the pilot beseeched Magellan for permission to take along the mother of his child, but Magellan allowed absolutely no women on the ships. Carvalho would sail alone. Alarmed by the prospect of other liaisons affecting the crew, Magellan ordered an inspection of every inch of each ship for female stowaways. Several were found and swiftly returned to shore. When the fleet finally weighed anchor and sailed away, Indian women followed them in canoes, tearfully pleading with the men from distant shores to stay with them forever. Resuming a southerly course, the fleet reached Paranagua Bay, off the coast of Brazil, by the last day of 1519. On January 10th, the rolling hills and mountains of the South American coast yielded to barely discernible hummocks and the suggestion of offshore islands. Carvalho declared that they had arrived at Cape Santa Maria. It was now summer in the sub-equatorial regions, and Magellan wanted to take advantage of the relatively mild weather and traverse the strait before it turned cold. Magellan's hope for a swift completion to the expedition would not be fulfilled.